Hello and welcome to another podcast for the UK and European Sea and Sea Control and Maritime Security. Again, and this whole series, and I'm going to be starting off like this for probably a while, Matthew will not be joining us, Mr. Hipple, because he is fed up of his own voice. And so it's these series, the ones in the UK and Europe for the East Atlantic, are going to be hosted and edited by me, Alexander Clark, of the Phoenix Think Tank and King's College London. So any complaints, or more hopefully, comments of a positive nature, please direct them to me at my Twitter at @AC_NavalHistory. After saying all that, welcome to today's discussion, and it's going to be a very interesting one. We are going to be discussing escorts and the future of their roles and what they are going to be doing and what they are now. And we have joining us Chris Stockdale-Garbutt of SimSec and various other groups. Chris, would you like to introduce us?
Hello. Yes, hi. As you said, I'm Chris Stockdale. I'm an associate editor for the Centre of International Maritime Security. And the UK Captain President, just get a bit of a plug there. I hold a BA in history, and I've recently finished a Master of Arts course in Applied Strategy and International Security from the University of Plymouth and returning to the Navy College, Dartmouth.
And Paul Fisher.
Hello, Paul Fisher. I'm slightly at the opposite end of the spectrum in some ways. I'm a retired UK Navy commander. I now live in France, but my interest in particular is maritime and naval futures in the broadest sense. So I look at a lot of questions like this from a strategic, visionary, conceptual point of view. But I have a lifetime of experience, hands-on experience at sea and dealing with the procurement and building of various naval units.
Yeah, then. And also as a member of the Phoenix Think Tank.
Absolutely, yeah.
Which is why which is a method of getting dragged into these podcasts when you should be enjoying the sun in lovely France. So, let's start off with the big questions. We're discussing escorts. What is an escort? What do you define an escort as? Paul, do you want to start us off first?
Yeah, this is a slightly long answer because I've thought about this long and hard, and I find the word escort, like so many other words that have been used to describe small to medium-sized ships, warships, over the ages. I mean, you know, today's meaning of frigate and 200 years ago, the meaning of a frigate, they just don't, the words are the same, but there's no comparison. So escort seems to me to have been something that post-Second World War has been a generic name for non-specialist, general purpose, if you like, warships that are not too big and ocean-going. Now, I don't think this term is going to be fit for purpose, is becoming not fit for purpose as things develop in the beginning of the 21st century. I'll leave it at that to start with, but I'd like to come back after a while to talk about how I would derive a name to replace what I consider to be almost a misnomer, escort.
That's very useful, Paul. Chris, would you like to continue?
Right, yeah. I totally agree. I think as Paul says, you know, historically, escorts are sort of escorting fleets and merchant convoys. I don't really come from a naval background too much. Obviously, I'm related to SimSec, but specifically, I'm not sort of on the maritime level. But I do question what these, so to say, escorts are escorting. I think Paul's definition of being a multi-purpose ship is a very good one. I think that's a great definition. But like I say, I can't see what they're escorting so much these days.
Mm. I myself, coming from the sort of the history background, I have to admit I agree with both of you. And I look at these ships, and I always remember the definition for a cruiser. The reason it was called a cruiser was its job was to cruise the seas and protect your allied trade and attack enemy trade. And if you consider that definition nowadays, all of our warships, once they're over a certain size level, are capable of doing that. to a lesser or greater extent. So are all ships now cruisers? And again, if you work your way down, especially with the size margins, you know, we often have drawn artificial lines in the sand. I actually tend to say I prefer corvette as a phrase to frigate, because frigate is so associated with anti-submarine warfare. The moment you say you're building a frigate, anti-submarine warfare becomes its dominant factor. And I worry about that, especially with the Type 26 class coming up. And this is one of the reasons why we're having this conversation, because looking around Europe as a whole, the moment you put these names on ships, the moment you call them escorts, or the moment you define them as frigates, destroyers, or corvettes, it seems to me that we automatically change the design to fit the name, rather than building a design to fit the role we need it to do. Does that make sense?
Yes, I think that leads nicely on to sort of stepping back for a minute. I agree with all that. Names conjure up images and have connotations which various players can sort of look at and sort of decide what they want to think of it, rather than it being an objective description of what you're looking at. I take a step back and say, you know, what is the function? What is this type, whatever this type is, type of vessel, warship, meant to be doing? What are its roles, if you like? What are its functions? And if I may just step right back and just sort of take a UK perspective about a Navy, or our Navy, UK Navy, if you like, the Royal Navy. I put this up to as a start of the ten, as it were. If we look to the future, and of course this is all about to be debated in a broader context as well next year, that basically in the UK we have come up with what I call a three-part navy, and that it's basically centred around three functions, if you like. One, quite clearly, with the advent of the Queen Elizabeth aircraft carriers, is the existence of a strike carrier group centered around this capital ship, the Queen Elizabeth aircraft carrier. So that's one area. And we'll come on to that, because clearly it comprises of a group of ships which are centered around this important command and control platform and mobile airfield, if you like. The second area is that we have already built, effectively, and have no, there's no doubt that it will continue, an amphibious, you could call it an amphibious strike capability, with a set of specialist shipping which are actually called amphibious ships of various descriptions. And then the third area, which is often not talked about, is what I call maritime interdiction. That needs some flesh put on it. But if we take the first two groupings of ships, they are pretty much built for what one might call high-intensity operations. The maritime interdiction area, of which there is no defined specialist shipping, and this is where you can see where this is going, can be used both in support of the high-intensity operations associated with the strike carrier and the amphibious striking group, but also flexibly can be used independently for low-intensity operations. And there are a multitude of them. They can be used for patrolling, for surveillance, for insertion of small amphibious groups and so forth. You can go on and on with a whole list of small roles, but primarily it's about interdicting from the sea, a maritime interdiction capability. And I would suggest what we have called up to date frigates, escorts, whatever, corvettes, actually, what we're looking for is a maritime interdiction capability, which can be used independently, singleton, if you like, and also an essential component of both the amphibious striking group and the carrier strike group, because these groups require smaller units that can be displaced, moved around, and support, provide part of what I call the maritime mix of capabilities. So a bit long-winded, but I see that, for me, I see, cutting to the chase, that the Type 26 needs to be looked at from having a very specific role, one that just isn't just a filler, if you like, escort, yes, as you quite rightly say, escorting what? It should be viewed as having a particular capability of maritime interdiction. It should be self-sufficient as a warship in that it can look after itself, but not necessarily other ships like the Type 45, which has an area air defense capability, very specific role. But all can also be used in support of these two main tenets of British naval power. Bit long-winded, but there we are.
I have to say, before I pass it on to Chris, because I think he's got some very good things, because what I've been discussing with him in the past, to add on to this, I would like to point out with the Type 45s, and this is the thing I always find most interesting, because they are called Area Air Defence Destroyers, they made the choice to go for the Silver A-50 VLS, which is the fastest available vertical launch system for missiles and for air defence missiles. And they chose not to go for the A-70, which had been larger and capable of taking the scalp, or the Mark 41 VLS, which is, of course, the American BAE standard model. And both of those other two options, the Mark 41 especially, would have allowed the capability of taking ASROC, Tomahawk cruise missiles, all these sorts of systems, which would have made them general purpose. Because they were designed as an area air defence destroyer, they orientated the weapons onto that. And I love that the phrase that often appears with them is they are fitted for, but not with, the Mark 41 VLS. Well, if they're fitted with those extra 16 cells of Mark 41, we'd suddenly be talking about Britain having a general purpose destroyer. And if you think back to the Syrian situation or a scenario and other scenarios we faced, how much more cruise missiles would we have had available? Which we wouldn't have had to have, well, with submarines, of course, the trouble is not firing the missiles. They're very good at getting close and firing the missiles. It's reloading them after they've fired them. Anyway, moving on to Chris. What would you like to add?
Well, I guess, if it's okay, just go back to this issue of escorting. Are we saying, gentlemen, that the technology has kind of made escorting in its traditional sense sort of obsolete because these vessels are now capable of providing their own defence? Would that be right?
I'd say it's not so much they're capable of providing for their own defence as they can provide quite a formidable defence, and you now push the escorts out further from the ships. And you're talking about task group procurement. The escorts no longer are escorting a specific capital ship. They are part of a task group. And whilst they are part of the protected screen of that task group, they're also part of its offensive firepower. Far more than, let's say, maybe in the Second World War, where the destroyers were part of the defensive screen as a rule, and they would only be used as part of an offensive thing if the enemy got really close.
It's more of a supporting role. Would that be...
It depends. They can change hats. If you've got something like an Arleigh Burke or even a Nudramussen, well, not the Nudramussen, the Ivar Helleneng, the frigate version of the Danish Navy, with its very capable suite of weaponry, one day it could be the principal air warfare protection of a task group. Next day, it could be, well, next minute, it could be its principal strike weapon, attacking enemy ships. The next, after that, it could be using its helicopter for anti-submarine warfare. And, you know, each escort now, each of these vessels is now so capable in so much areas and is provided with such a range of weaponry, as a rule. And especially if you consider this even more so in the European navies, which are smaller and therefore depend more on the smaller number of ships to do so many different missions, that calling them escorts is almost like, well, you going up to a limousine and saying, oh, that's just a car. You know, it's going up to, well, not even a limousine, going up to an Aston Martin and saying, that's okay, that'll get me from A to B. You don't buy an Aston Martin because it'll get you from A to B. You buy an Aston Martin because it'll get you to A to B very nicely and do lots of fun things on the way. And that's the thing with these warships. They are not just escorts. They're not just there to escort things. They do a lot of things on their own. And also, they spend a lot of time on their own. If you consider the guard ships which go out to the Caribbean, the Falklands, all around the world, we have these individual ships. HMS Daring recently did around the world voyage, practically, visiting China and Australia and all these countries. She's going out there. She's seeing the world. She took part in the disaster relief. She was the first British ship to arrive for disaster relief in the Philippines. And she did an excellent job. And So when you're calling her an escort, yes, she can escort a task group, and she will do it very well. But she can do so much more. And so the trouble is, when you use the phrase escort, you're sort of downplaying them.
Yes, and the disservice to some of the capabilities these vessels have got, isn't it?
Yes.
Mm. Yeah, I think it's important to understand that... I think you made a very almost an aside there, Alex, about looking at the task group as a whole, and I think that was the point I was trying to probably sort of didn't develop it very much. But when one looks at the composition of all the vessels that you might wish to put into a, for instance, let's take an amphibious group. I mean, not only is there the specialist amphibious shipping which enables your helicopters to move people around and for landing craft to move backwards and forwards from the main ships and so forth and so on, very important command and control functions and the self-protection of that group, which, as you rightly say, includes vessels like the Type 45. I see these, what I'm calling maritime interdiction vessels, as vessels that are needed as to provide other aspects of the task group's integral and integrated protection. So, as forming parts of the, as you quite rightly say, the defensive screen of ships around the high value units. You know, there are only two or three Type 45s around. They, of course, the roles aren't mutually exclusive. There is enormous overlap. But clearly, in the commander's view, a Type 45's primary role is going to be such that they are positioned to provide the anti-missile defense for that group. Whereas something like... there's a whole blend of vehicles that are required to protect that task group against submarine attack, and they range from helicopters through to units that have their own sonar, through to long-range maritime patrol aircraft, and so on. And so I see that these maritime interdiction units, which can operate on their own, which provide their own inherent capability, both in their ability to attack a submarine, to attack a surface ship, and to defend themselves against air attack, I think they provide, the force multiplier that you require for defense in depth. And I think that's an important thing, that it's an integrated view of maritime warfare that's required, and it does require some numbers. A different thread is that it's all very well having ships, but a ship, there is one unique feature of a ship. It can only be in one place at one time. And so the numbers question comes into this. You do need, in my view, slightly less expensive than the 1 billion a shot Type 45. You do need a spectra, you know, some ships that are slightly cheaper, so that you can buy a few more of them, because they are needed around, because they have so many roles that they can fulfil. It gives that flexibility of presence and so forth.
I would just add to that one. I know the Type 45s are often called £1 billion ships, but there is the fact that the research, etc., and everything was costed around the construction of 12. Which was then cut to 10 and then cut to 8, and everything went down, and eventually have six ships which are shoved with all the R&D costs, and they actually cost about 500 to 50, yep. 550 million units to build,
yep.
But the research costs, and if we include, if we've built all 12, we'd be talking about, well, 700 million pound ships, yep. Instead of a billion, yep. pound ships.
Yeah.
And this is also half the trouble with, you know, if you think, not just with the UK, but with Europe as a whole. We've been cutting our defence and cutting our ships numbers, and this is an aside to this topic, and it's increased their costs, because you design a class and the research and development around building a certain number of ships, and then you don't build that number of ships.
Yep.
And, you know, look at some of the issues the French have tried to sell their Fremmes to Greece, etc., even after the financial crisis began, so they could sell more of these ships without having to buy them themselves.
Absolutely, yes. Well, of course, that was the rather sorry history of the, which resulted in the UK getting the Type 45 destroyer that originally it started off, I mean, a long time ago, as a NATO project with 20 nations in it, and it gradually got whittled down to three nations when they had the tri-national program with Italy and France, and then, of course, the UK pulled out and decided to build its own.
Well, that's the thing. The Horizon-class frigates, it wasn't in the end, and it was actually quite brave in a way, I still think, to do this, because the Horizon-class frigate was a great idea for three nations to combine and build this sort of mixed frigate. And what I love is, as the Frem has turned out, which is its descendant, that's come in and that's got an anti-submarine warfare and an air defence version, so you can build both and have the same ship and commonality throughout the fleet. But for the Royal Navy, the thing is, it just wasn't big enough to go around the world. And that's what we need it to do. And that's, in the end, your trouble. It's sort of a case of, we want to operate around the world, and this comes with the escorts. I also would like to give a sort of big up here at the moment to the seven Provincian class frigates of the Royal Netherlands Navy, because they are very interesting ships, because they have one thing on them which I would really love on the Type 45s. Ballistic missile defense. They have the same radar we have on the Type 45, but because they carry the Mark 41 VLS, and even though they're a frigate, they can carry the SM3 and provide for NATO the ballistic missile defense, which is again something. These things are called frigates and are called escorts, but they're your primary ballistic missile defense system.
That's true.
But moving on from war, you know, we have also all these issues that, with the expenses you were pointing out with the ships, we don't have enough, and now we have issues happening with piracy, and we don't have enough ships to send out there, and we have civilians coming in armed with weapons and all those issues. And I think Chris has something to add on that, because I.
I just wanted to get onto the point. I suppose this is where escorting, in many respects, comes into its own, because with the rise of things like Somalian piracy and piracy off the West Coast, maybe escorting in its very traditional sense could again come into its own. I know that sort of has been mooted, and companies like Blackwater and a few others, although that wasn't a very successful example, have tried this. And maybe this is something that the sort of conventional navies could look at again, bringing in escort vessels to escort merchant ships along the vulnerable shipping lanes. I'd be quite interested to see what Paul said to that, because it is Navy background.
Yes, I think that there's a lot of mileage here. There are lots of ways of sort of, if you like, skinning this cat. I have to say that personally, I mean, there are arguments against it, that a lower cost, simpler, however you like to put it, frigate-sized, if you like to use that, vessel that can undertake low-intensity operations is most certainly a useful ship, warship, to have in your inventory. As an example, the French Lafayette class, incredibly leanly manned, and built exactly for that, to be able to disappear off and do things for long periods of time on their own, and provide a basic capability In fact, it was built primarily to replace, I think, their A69 class frigates, and it's worked quite well. I do think the numbers issue is important, and I think there is a balance to be struck between the number of hulls that you end up with and the level of sophistication. The great thing is, if you've got the hulls, if something happens in 10 years' time, you can always retrofit something. But if you don't have the hulls, you can't.
And, of course, that was the great story of the Leander class, which was sold all around the world. I mean, I can't remember how many navies had them at one point. Mm. I just sort of, it's all on top of my head. But they were employed by pretty much everyone.
Yeah.
And they worked brilliantly. And the thing was, they could be upgraded. You know, if I remember correctly, the Leander class, some of them in the Falklands War were actually carrying Seawolf missiles, and there were almost more of them down there at the point with Leanders with Seawolfs than the Type 22s, which are always associated as the iconic Seawolf warship.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
And you had this ship which was built by Britain, and it served with the Royal Navy, the Indian Navy, New Zealand Navy, Chilean Navy, Netherlands Navy, Pakistan Navy, Ecuadorian, Indonesian Navy. It sort of equipped the world. Mm. It was almost, and it's what the model which the Americans sort of built the Oliver Hazard Perry class on, in that you build a ship which is cheap, cheerful, can do the job, and you can upgrade it later to do what you need.
Yes, yeah, that's
and
right.
I would point out, we actually have a design sitting in our inventory which is perfect for that. It's called the River class.
Mm.
They are incredibly, if you look at their size and their space, underused in terms of weapons fit, etc. And even with a slight extension, you could fit a small hangar on the back of them for a Lynx-sized helicopter or a UAV, which more likely these days, a rotary UAV, and you would have a perfect ship for doing most of these duties.
Yeah.
We have lots of programs going on. I always notice there are always lots of programs. I'm sorry I'm monopolizing a bit here, but there are lots of programs like the TF2000 class frigates the Turkish are building, which are based on the German design. And you've got the Germans who are always pushing around these big frigates and building themselves. But then at the same time, they're selling the Miko class around the world, which are these cheap upgradable frigates. And I do sometimes think that perhaps navies, and they're seeking to be, and please comment on this, and they're seeking to be world class and first class. They build the best warships they can possibly build, and then they don't have enough ships. And partially that might be a reaction to their worry that they're not going to have enough money to build those ships later, if they, with treasuries being as they are. But part of it also seems to be this sort of status. What do you think?
Yeah, Chris, do you want to come in on that to start with?
I think I think what you say, Alex, is true. I think navies are quite a big projection of power, but I suppose it has to be a fine line between that and sort of budgetary costs. Mm. So it's a very difficult balance.
Yes, I think there's another issue which is also we shouldn't forget about too much, and that's the number of people that you need to man these vessels. It is, in my view, we have for too long put too many people, or required that we need a lot of people to man some of these vessels. One has to really compare this with a merchant marine in the sense that to move the hull around, to sail the ship, if you like, in the merchant marine, you're talking about, you know, even the largest of vessels, because there's no difference in principle, between 15 and at the very most 20 people. Now, that's just to sail the ship, as it were. Now, I accept that, obviously, everything else you put in terms of a warfighting capability needs additional people. But I really wonder whether we should be targeting, you know, 130, 140 people. Are we not over-egging this? And I think manpower is a big issue when it comes to the through life costs of these vessels. Manpower is an enormous drag.
And also, it's something which tends to grow as time goes on.
It does.
And that's something I always find interesting. But I often get pointed out when I have raised this figure myself, oh, yes, but they need boarding parties and this and that. And that's true. But then I look at something like the Nunramusen class, which its crew goes up and down depending on what mission it's doing. And this is what the Danish do. And they have a very much a flexible module system of weaponry and equipment they can fit onto it. So they can alter its pattern very quickly. It comes into port, and it comes into port maybe as a minesweeper, and it leaves as a long-range patrol vessel.
I have to say I'm highly critical about the UK's approach to this. I must say this. There is a need for a much more innovative approach to these sorts of vessels, which is one of the reasons, and I come back to this, that I use this expression maritime interdiction vessel, because in itself, I don't mean specialist in the sense of it means, you know, specialist is what I call, you know, amphibious shipping is specialist. It's special to amphibious operations. What I'm saying is that these vessels, which are generally smaller, look like a frigate, if you like to try and conjure up a picture of it. They actually have a specific role. They are there to go out and do naval type things, both on their own and in groups, and support other naval activities. I mean, we don't have any problem in conceptualizing a mine hunter or a supply ship or an aircraft carrier. But I think going back to your original question of, you know, escorting, yes, I think escorting, as Chris said, I think it is a role amongst many others that what I call maritime interdiction forces need to look at. It's a pretty old, you know, it's a pretty old concept. We used to send ships out to, and I'm not suggesting we do this in the future, to plunder Spanish convoys coming in from the Americas, because it was a pretty lucrative business. And I mean, we used to send out ships that were, if you like, general purpose warships to do that job. And those ships used to do a lot of other jobs as well. And I think, you know, that was really maritime interdiction to go and raid gold and silver ships, bullion ships coming back from the Americas. And I think, you know, if it's a matter of escorting our own valuable cargoes, we are a maritime nation, 95% of our trade comes by sea. I think Chris is right. We need to be thinking about how we most effectively do that. And I think we need some shipping which is built for low-intensity operations, can keep up with merchant ships, and can provide that assurance and security in the broadest sense for our maritime trade around the world. So I think, you know, in that sense, there is an escort aspect of it, but we shouldn't limit ourselves to saying, oh, this is just an escort vessel. It's, you know, well, actually, you cut the numbers down because we don't need that many because they're just escorts. They don't really have a primary function. And that's what I'm trying to get home, that we need to get into the language, if you like, this concept that small, reasonably quick, long endurance warships, which can look after themselves, be self-supporting, have a role in themselves. It's not exclusive, but they have a role. And the role is actually a very old role of going out. I mean, I hate to use the word gunboat diplomacy, but these gunboats that used to go out around the world weren't gunboats. They were general workhorse, if you like, in modern parlance, maritime interdiction units. That's my case. I don't know if that makes sense to you. I'd like to hear what you think.
I have to say, with aircraft carriers and LHDs, I've stopped using that because I call them aviation ships. Right. The reason I say that is they are big flat top decks. And it's amazing, with a carrier or a LHD, you just chop that air group round and you've suddenly got a carrier. Yes, it looks like an LHD, but it's big enough, and some of them are definitely big enough to be small carriers.
Yeah.
With the with Harriers and F-35Bs, etc., these ships are suddenly capable. And For example, for the Royal Navy, if it built an Ocean and Illustrious replacement and got a couple of LHDs, then with the Queen's, it would have four aviation ships. And yes, let's say the worst happens. One of the Queen's is in refit and one has an accident. Then if you've got the other two, let's say the two LHDs, one of them was in reserve, you bring it out of reserve, you stick in the carrier air group into it, and it's your carrier.
This is not new at all. Suez crisis, this happened. HMS Centaur, which was an aircraft carrier, was very quickly converted into a helicopter carrier for landing troops.
Yes. And
so, I mean, it's not new at all. I agree with you.
And I would apply this down to the warship and to the warships around them. I think the trouble is, to sell the ships to the public and the government, you need to use one of the names they understand. And because defence debate has been marginalised so since the interwar years and has really been pushed away, as people want, and quite rightly, they want peace. So they try to ignore war, I think, as much as possible. And so they only know these names which have been sort of in the movies that about the Second World War, the destroyers, the frigates. And the moment you start to try and sell it to the Treasury, to sell it to the public, you have to use this language so that they understand what you're saying, and that immediately traps you down.
Yeah.
And it stops the ships being able to argue for themselves on their roles and their duties, because the moment you say, we need so many frigates, they go, well, are we really going to be fighting an enemy with that many submarines? As it is, it seems like those people who are suggesting that Russia's reports of Russia's demise as a power might be overstated are possibly having some sort of I told you so drinks at the moment. But it's not just, we can't just always think of the enemy we have now, we had in the last 10 years. When you build a warship design, they're going to be serving in your fleet for 20, possibly 30 years, and you have to start thinking, I think, and this is something you have to, governments which are only elected for 4 or 5 year terms probably have quite a lot of trouble considering, is that the ships you build now are going to be the ones you're facing, whoever's your enemy, in 20 years' time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I can sort of pick up on that a little bit. I hear you, Kate, I totally agree. But although I've got a sort of an academic military background, when I look at it, we've got vessels that are tagged as escort ship. We have a situation, which we can't deny, where piracy is becoming a really big issue. For example, Captain Phillips is in the media, it's a big thing, it's really escalating. These ships should be used in that sort of role. It's okay having carriers and destroyers and everything else, but at the moment we have an immediate threat, and we have assets that aren't necessarily being used to the best of their capability. And in my opinion, I think we should start looking at that and maybe trying to get these ships to act as a more positive deterrent against piracy, against any sort of attack, and deal with an immediate issue rather than potentially try and react to something that we don't know what the future holds, and try and deal with something that we can tackle at the moment.
Well, Chris, I happen to agree. I do agree with that. I think that there is a need to demonstrate the utility of today's naval forces. Now, there are two issues here. One is, yes, I agree with that. I personally don't think enough has been done to demonstrate the utility of the, as you call it, escorting warship. I'm just a bit nervous about classifying these ships as escorts. I accept that it is a function that they need to be able to undertake. I would prefer to see it that I agree with your other point, Alex, the point about nomenclature being something that conjures up something in the public mind. I think that's very, very important. And as you quite rightly say, because the debate about the military in general, but the Navy in particular, has been so sort of diminished in the public eye, and the general level of knowledge about naval forces is relatively low in the UK. I mean, we even have examples on the TV of, you know, talking about the army doing something when in fact it's the Royal Marines, or the army doing something, or the Air Force doing something when in fact it's a naval helicopter. I mean, that's a very simple example.
The amount of times BBC News refers to the deployment of a battleship.
Yes, exactly. So that is an important issue, and I think Chris is right, that to demonstrate today with, and I think they're probably inadequate to a certain extent, some of the existing ships that we have, but it's still important to demonstrate what naval forces can do. And I do agree with you. I think that it needs to be a much greater emphasis on explicitly showing that our naval forces are there to protect, to provide security for, to protect, whatever words you like to use, of our vital interests, which, of course, is trade, of which I've said before, is much of it comes by sea. And so I totally agree with that. And so from that, we need to develop the nomenclature to describe these ships in a way that is both evocative but also describes their utility. I think that's really important to me, and I'm very interested to hear your comment, Alex, that in the public's mind, a frigate is something to do with anti-submarine warfare. For me, it isn't, and I come from a naval background. I don't look at it like that, but I'm interested to see that that's the perception. And I think I don't think naval people have spent enough time articulating in understandable language the value and the functions of assets that we have and want to have in the future. So long way round all that, but I think there's much merit in that. I come back to my basic premise. I am nervous about calling, for the reasons that we've just all been discussing, these ships escorts only. I think that limits the view of their utility. Yes, they can escort other vessels, and we should be using them for that as a low intensity operation. But I'm not so sure we should be just designing them with that in mind.
And I'm just going to chuck in a couple of things here into the conversation to see what it produces. With that and the public associating frigates with anti-submarine warfare, that one is something which I've found in experience when I've been talking with just general members of the public, and when I've gone in and done talks with schools, you bring up frigate, they think submarines. And you have this whole thing these days where people put one weapon system against another. And with navies, it's not one weapon system. It's not land-based missiles versus a carrier. It's land-based missiles versus a carrier battle group. It's land-based missiles and land-based aircraft versus a carrier battle group with multiple task forces part of it. And this is what has to be shown and has to be demonstrated, because so often people try and set it up so it's simple analysis. It's one thing versus one thing, and naval warfare is more complex than that.
Absolutely.
And the other thing I'm going to put in is, well, if escorts doesn't work, I also would say that the phrase surface combatants doesn't work. Because the moment you use the phrase surface combatants, you think of war fighting. And these escorts, these ships, these vessels, do so much more than just war fighting. Because war fighting, if you consider the town class cruisers, which the Royal Navy had and in the Second World War, and they'd served in the interwar years before that, and they served many years after the Second World War. But we always, whenever you're talking about them, if you go look up their histories, etc., it will have, majority of that history will be focused on their Second World War service, which was just 5-6 years of their lives. And they served 20-30 years. And they did all sorts of things. They did deterrence against the Japanese in the Far East for as long as they could. You know, as long as they could deter them, they did. This sort of things. And we forget that. I often think in the debates about these ships, we forget the fact that they do so much more, and they have to be built for so much more. I was so happy when I learned the Type 45s were being built with spaces which could be used for entertaining. For the most basic of naval diplomacy, holding a party when you come into port for the visiting dignitaries. That is something which it cannot be overstated how useful that facility is for making contacts, for making friends, for building relationships, which can allow you in years later, when there's trouble, to pick up the phone, call someone and go, so what's happening here?
Yeah,
because you know them. And what do you two think to that?
Well,
Chris, you go.
Well, well, to follow from your point, I suppose you've got the cases of these ships becoming almost sort of floating embassies. And I'm sort of getting onto the maritime peace building side of things in my studies. And the flexibility of these types of vessels is becoming increasingly important, and their role is going beyond that of their warfighting capability. They are becoming more diplomatically important, more important in humanitarian missions, logistics, all sorts of different angles that that really goes beyond a lot of their, I suppose, their design, really, in many cases. So I think a lot of what you say is spot on.
Paul?
Yes. I do agree. I think that I think that's a very interesting point, Chris. I've just vigorously writing that while you were saying it. Not for this discussion, but I'd like to follow up on that because another issue. But we can talk about that outside this podcast. But yes, I agree. And this is something which is, you know, it's not one of these things that you can measure very easily. It's very intangible in a sense. But I do agree. I think that the value of, and as I say, the value of, I'm having difficulty now knowing what to call these things, because they're clearly ships and they're clearly naval ships. I mean, that's as, and they're clearly not specialist. I can say what they're not, like they're not carriers of aircraft and they're not amphibious ships in that sense. So I think this difficulty in defining these basic building blocks, if you like, of these naval vessels, needs some real thought, and it needs development, and it does require you to come down, as we've all agreed, with a neat phrase. I know that's an awful thing to say, but you've got to capture this sort of in a phrase or two or three words or a word what you actually are trying to conjure up. I do agree with that. I do agree with the detail points. I don't think surface combatant is right. It's, you know, it's a sort of mealy mouth way of saying warship, but I mean, it's so I don't know.
If you're going to say that, you might as well say warship. It's less used and it's less politically correct.
Yeah, exactly. It's quite definitive, and everybody knows what you're talking about. Because if you said to the man in the street, you know, a surface combatant, does that mean it's a water skier with an AK-47? I mean, you know, I'm being stupid when I say that, but warship is quite clearly defined in people's minds. And it's interesting that you don't normally talk about aircraft carriers as warships. I know they are, but they're normally talked about in their own right as aircraft carrier. And it's an interesting bit of language, this. But I do think we need to hone this down a bit. And I agree with all the business about other, what I call low intensity activities like peacemaking, peacekeeping, humanitarian activities, disaster relief, showing the flag, whatever other words you like to use for this. Diplomacy. I mean, that's a maritime diplomacy. And this is something that all these things are very good at. I think it was making a cheap shot now. I think it was a great shame on one hand that, you know, the Royal Yacht was got rid of. And I'm not saying we should have one. I'm just saying what we lost in that was this incredible symbol and facility for trade. I mean, I witnessed it personally, and it was enormous. But it's an interesting dynamic, which we have, as the UK has sort of withdrawn into itself a bit, we've been unwilling to say these, to sort of demonstrate these things.
Yes, and I think you do sort of... You need to be unafraid to shout how good you are, and I think that's the trouble with diplomacy, etc., with the things with the with losing the royal yacht. I always remember a anecdote I heard about it where it turned up in New York and deals which had been sitting on ice for 12, 18 months were signed in a morning on a breakfast on it because they just hosted breakfast for all these deals which need to be signed. They rang up the embassy, said, which deals are still in difficulties? Okay, invite all the people to come sign them on the royal yacht. There was no members of the royal family board. There was nothing like that. It was just you being used as a mobile embassy.
Absolutely.
And I think special.
Yes, and I think that's I'd like to take that up as a separate subject somewhere else, but I agree with you. I think it's an important role for navies. Let's put it like that.
I will refer you to an introduction where I said I'm editing and starting these hosting these East Atlantic podcasts, and any suggestions for more, I'm happy to put through because it's a very good podcast.
Yeah.
The other thing I'm going to say before I let you guys have the floor, is the more we keep going around it, the more I come back to a phrase which I said at the beginning, and I didn't realize how much I would think about it the whole way through this podcast, cruiser. Now it's going to sound strange, but if you look at what these ships do, and what we expect them to do, then more and more they are becoming, we are more and more putting them into what is the cruiser role. Mm. They do the war fighting, they do the peace fighting, they do all these things. And that is what we used to have the cruisers for. And we used to have light and heavy cruisers to design the two types. The heavy cruisers were were more for war fighting, the light cruisers were more for trade protection, peacekeeping. And I do sometimes wonder whether, and been wondering, I said sometimes been wondering through this conversation, whether that going back to that phraseology would actually solve a lot of problems of just having light and heavy cruisers. Although you can feel free to shoot me down for being insane.
Go on, Chris.
Looking at it, although I have to say I quite like Paul's idea of a multi-purpose ship. I think that sounds, that sort of covers all the bases really. But I did hear where you came from, Alex.
What about Paul?
Well, yeah, I think it's a conundrum. It's for me, it's a conundrum because I'm quite comfortable with, I mean, I think most people are, when they see something like, you know, if you want to use the technical language, landing platform dock, it's quite clearly for amphibious operations. A ship that's got a very big runway on top of it is an aircraft carrier. And I think, you know, we've complicated it ourselves by having multiple words like destroyer, frigate, cruiser in that sense. You know, we used to have, I mean, when Tiger and Blake were around, which were the last defined ships defined as cruisers, you know, we had cruisers, destroyers, we had what were they called, the GMDs, I can't remember, the county class well, they were almost cruisers. They were enormous ships.
They were originally they came from what was the destroyer cruiser design.
That's it.
And eventually they were sold and produced and officially classed as destroyers, but they have been built with cruiser facilities aboard.
Exactly. So we've made this incredibly complicated ourselves by having frigates, destroyers, cruisers, all this mix without really having thought too much about it. And then we've added recently with the Type 45 destroyer, which is, you know, it's quite an aggressive sounding name. When you could argue that, you know, if one had adopted one word like frigate and just, and and either suffixed it or prefixed it with what its speciality was, that might have made it easier for people. We're in a bit of a quandary, and I do think this is worth more thought as to you know what it's to be called. It's certainly raised a question in my mind, but I think for me what's needed is simplicity, and most of all something that the public understand that this particular war vessel is the descriptor for it. I'm not sure what it is, but it definitely needs to be it's almost like a sort of form of branding in a sense, because you can define it as however you like.
That's true.
It is the problem. It's a form of branding what you're talking about, and branding is all about evoking in the audiences, and let's face it, the audience is the taxpayer in one sense, what they're getting.
And that I think, so it
chimes with Chris's point. You know, there is an immediate problem which has been going on for some time, which is piracy all over the world. Well, there are some choke points, but generally it's a pretty widespread problem. You know, what the public want to know, well, what's the Navy doing about this? I mean, that's basically it. And, you know, if it means, well, we're using X to escort these ships to provide them with added security and so on, then that would make sense. But, you know, it's diffuse at the moment. It's not clear in people's minds. And I suspect that if we can't state this clearly, then there's a measure of confusion within the rationale of what we're actually doing.
More than likely. Chris, anything you want to add?
No, I completely agree. I've just been thinking, really, what I mentioned before, that I suppose a lot of it comes down to sort of naming. I mean,
yeah,
you know, destroyers and aircraft carriers, in case in point, have much more capability than that. And I suppose it comes down the same with escorts as well. The naming is quite misleading.
Yes.
In many respects. I think this is the crux of the whole argument that we're, sort of debate we're having here.
Yes.
So maybe the problem is that we need some more classifications for these vessels. That may be simplified a little bit, but I think it's a very interesting topic that obviously maybe needs looking at.
Well, just reading the back of my Jane's Warship Recognition Guide, which I just found by my foot, and I'm not sure why it was down by my foot, but I just did. It has a good, let's see, 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, about 12, 14 different descriptions for what we would call escorts.
Yeah.
But the trouble is, there are things like destroyer escort, destroyer guided missile, destroyer helicopter. Well, most destroyers these days carry helicopters and guided missiles, and they can all do escorting. So I'm not really sure if these designators that are still in service and were obviously put together in the early years of the Cold War are still fit for purpose, perhaps.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's reached about the hour point, so what I was going to say was, would you both like to sort of sum up your points? And, you know, Chris, anyone who wants to put a plug for their websites, and I'm going to let Chris do the plug for SimSec, so I don't have to remember their website name, and then I will do the PTT at the end.
Yeah, so. Thanks. Yeah, just as you said, I think, you know, SimSec, Center for International Maritime Security, definitely worth looking at. Very good group, a lot of debate, a lot of discussion. Check it out.
Paul?
Yeah, I, as a newcomer to the Phoenix think tank, I think it's excellent that these podcasts are going ahead. I would just like to put two points. One is, I think we need to spend more effort in defining some of the concepts and the concepts which underwrite and underpin the capabilities that we want in the future, which was the reason I highlighted this concept of strike carrier, amphibious strike, and maritime interdiction. And the second thing I would say is that we really need, as a naval community, to become much more focused on, hackneyed expression, our customer, which is the public, who we are here to provide capabilities for the taxpaying public. And I think we need to communicate with them in a way which is understandable. I think the fact that we aren't able to says that we probably haven't got our thoughts clear in the first place.
Well, I would say I'd agree with both of those, and especially on the point of looking at the Phoenix Think Tank and SimSec. Both are excellent websites. And I would say, I would add in that I doubt this is going to be the last time you're going to hear from this group, because it's been a very excellent podcast, and I think we've got many thoughts to come back and have again. And I will be very happy if you two gentlemen would like to come back and talk again on this subject, and maybe we'll get in someone else if you fancy it, and discuss this again, because I think it's been an excellent podcast. And thank you very much for taking part.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.